Good afternoon, Dean Minow, Ms. Power, Professor Klarman, Ms. Murciano, faculty, administrators, graduates, family, and friends. On behalf of the class of 2010, we would like to welcome you to our class day exercises. Before we receive our diplomas tomorrow, we celebrate on class day the Harvard Law School community and just a few of the many faculty, staff, and students who have contributed to it. But first, we would like to take this opportunity to thank all of the families and friends in attendance for their support and encouragement throughout these 3 years at Harvard Law School. We wouldn't be here without you.
Although tomorrow we will all be dressed identically and standing together when President Faust confers our degrees on us, what's so remarkable about attending this law school is that it provides us the resources to take incredibly different paths to tomorrow's ceremony. No two graduates had the same Harvard Law experience, so Jess and I would like to describe the experiences of some of the class members of 2010.
Some of us joined one of the law school honor societies like the Law Review, the Legal Aid Bureau, or the Board of Student Advisors.
Some of us did not.
Some of us spent our time here working in the basements of Hastings and Pound Hall, producing the most highly cited law journals in the country.
Some of us did not.
Some of us met the person we're going to marry here at Harvard Law School.
Some of us did not.
Some of us went to class.
Some of us did not.
Some of us wondered whether it was worse to get an LP or a B minus.
Some of us can tell you.
Some of us go out every weekend with the incredible friends we've made over the last 3 years.
You always say you're busy, Jess.
Some of us got food at the 100 Days Lunch.
Some of us did not.
Some of us got used to the idea that it might snow in April.
No, Jess, no one ever got used to that. So no matter what you did with your time at Harvard Law School, each of us deserves to be and should be extremely proud. We hope you'll be able to take some time to reflect on this remarkable achievement.
We are honored to have Ms. Samantha Power, Senior Advisor in the Obama Administration and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, address our class today. We would like to take this opportunity to thank the members of the Law School Administration, particularly Dean Cosgrove and the staff of the Dean of Students Office, for their commitment to our class and to making the law school a better place. Congratulations and best of luck to you all, Harvard Law School class of 2010.
My name is Harold Hope, and on behalf of the Harvard Law School Association, I want to thank you for having me here today. I know that today and tomorrow are to some extent about looking backwards and celebrating your time here in Cambridge. And I congratulate you on your achievements and on the occasion of your graduation. But I want to take a minute just to look forward and to tell you about the community that awaits you after you graduate. But first, maybe I'll look back as well for a few moments and all the way back to the 1880s. Harvard Law School back then was barely 60 years old. And Dean Griswold, who was writing a history of the law school, wrote about that time that after some difficult years at HLS, the law school was experiencing a time of rebirth and showing considerable signs of new vitality. I think there are some similarities to those days when we look at today with a new dean in Martha Minow and with what we all hope are the worst of the economic troubles behind us. But back to 1886, you know, back then there was a growing alumni body. And it was the first time that people said there should be an organization devoted to the alumni of law school. Four graduates got together, and being good lawyers, they wrote down a mission for an alumni organization. And that mission today is the same as it was almost 125 years ago: to advance the cause of legal education, to promote the interest and increase the usefulness of Harvard Law School, and to promote mutual acquaintance and good fellowship among all members of the association. You know, today that association that they founded, the Harvard Law School Association, has more than 33,000 members. This is not an association about fundraising, although believe me, there are other people at Harvard Law School who will have your number for that. This is a foundation, this is an association that is about community, a community of remarkable people like you that that is diverse, engaged, and global. Whatever your passion, there are other alumni who share it. Whatever your goals, there are other alumni who can help you achieve them. Your network is not just the class of 2010, but it's a network of all Harvard Law School alumni, past, present, and future. I welcome you today to this association. I encourage you to get involved in it. And on this your class day, I wish you good luck and Godspeed.
Dean Minow, distinguished faculty, honored guests, and fellow graduates of the class of 2010. Speaking on behalf of my fellow classmates and friends, I think we'd like to recognize the hundreds of parents and loved ones who are here with us, in person or in memory, and whose support, guidance, and example has been indispensable in our being here today. This is your day as much as it is ours. In addition, we would like to express our sympathies to the thousands who will be subjected to repeat viewings of today's ceremony on living room couches for years to come. We thank you, future spouses, offspring, and dinner guests, for your patience over the next 6.5 hours. And we apologize that Dad was still learning the Zoom button. My fellow graduates, this afternoon, we gather to celebrate each other's well-earned accomplishments. A little over 3 years ago, we received a phone call from Toby Stock, inviting us to join the impressive and impressively diverse class of 2010. Like many of you, I'm a child of immigrants. My parents came here from a country called Afghanistan. You may have heard of it. But the country they left was a different place than the one we've all heard about. They were newlyweds and people with the privilege of education. And they began a life together that was far different from the one they expected for themselves. But they never shrank from the demands they faced, no matter how unexpected. And they never missed one back-to-school night, parent-teacher conference, or award ceremony. And that's why I'm up here today talking about them. I know that behind each of us are people like my parents, for whom life may not have always passed as expected or desired, but who made sure, no matter what, that our lives never lacked for anything. So as we take our degrees and put them to use, let's never forget everything and everyone it took to get to this moment. With the acknowledgement that each of us, whatever hurdles we have overcome, has been blessed with much love, good fortune, and opportunity, I think it is appropriate to recognize the obligation we now have to those who brought us here and to those everywhere who want better for their loved ones than they had for themselves. Let us carry forward the enterprising spirit and determination that are the leading pillars of the Harvard Law School. We are part of a uniquely prominent academic institution whose quality of education and research creates and reshapes the boundaries that govern modern human relations and social dynamics. As the next generation of Harvard graduates, we are animated by a common spirit which demands that we not simply know our place in society, but that we create a society fit for us all. Years from today, let us look back at a lifetime in which we carried with us our experiences at Harvard and its historic mission as an agent of progressive change. Let us look back at a lifetime in which we worked tirelessly to anchor our communities to the course of advancement and commitment to the prosperity of our world. Let us remember our time here at this forum for interdisciplinary dialogue and diversity of thought. As a tangible and theoretical connecting force, commissioning us to blaze new trails of progress and prosperity in every endeavor we choose to pursue. It has been said that all work that is worth anything is done in faith. This afternoon, at this ceremony of heartfelt reminiscence and formidable expectation, Let us call upon ourselves to embrace the faith that every barrier hurdled by our fortitude, every individual stirred by our passion, and every challenge surmounted by our determination will enlighten our lives, inspire others, and transcend the confines of what is achievable on this earth. In short, let us never forget what each of us is capable of doing and what we are obligated to do, having received the privileges of awareness and conscience. I want to end this by sharing the most important lesson I learned at Harvard Law School. On our last day of our first semester here, a very special professor read a carefully selected poem to our section. Thank you, Professor Hansen, for reminding us that the most significant thing about going to Harvard Law School is the good we can do when we leave. It is titled Famous by Naomi Shihab Nye. The river is famous to the fish. The loud voice is famous to silence, which knew it would inherit the earth before anybody said so. The cat sleeping on the fence is famous to the birds, watching him from the birdhouse. The tear is famous briefly to the cheek. The idea you carry close to your bosom is famous to your bosom. The boot is famous to the earth, more famous than the dress shoe, which is famous only to floors. The bent photograph is famous to the one who carries it, and not at all famous to the one who is pictured. I want to be famous to shuffling men who smile while crossing streets, sticky children in grocery lines, famous as the one who smiled back. I want to be famous the way a pulley is famous, or a buttonhole, not because it did anything spectacular, but because it never forgot what it could do. Thank you, and my most heartfelt congratulations and best wishes to the class of 2010.
Thank you, Nilab. On behalf of the class of 2010, I am pleased to announce to you the results of our class gift campaign. This year, 23% of our class, that's 131 graduating students, contributed to the class of 2010 gift. Special mention must be made of Section 7, which achieved the highest participation rate of the 7-1L sections. To date, 35% of Section 7, that's 27 of the 77 students, chose to contribute to the class gift. As a result, Section 7's contribution will be commemorated on a plaque to be placed on permanent display here on campus. Congratulations to Section 7. For the success of the gift overall, thanks are owed to each of you who contributed, but particularly to the members of the class committee, whose names are printed on today's program, for encouraging their classmates to give. Many of us participated in the class gift in different amounts and for different reasons, including starting a new student-led, student-funded fellowship to support a law student in carrying out a public interest project for a year. Each of us who gave recognized that the idea of the class gift is not to drum up a huge sum of money, but rather to help begin that spirit of giving back that is so essential to Harvard Law School's continued ability to fund the amazing variety of programs, its ability to hire and keep brilliant and inspirational professors, and its ability to attract and produce future leaders like yourselves. Dean Minow, on behalf of the class of 2010, it is my honor to present Harvard Law School with our class gift of $3,086.15. Please spend it wisely.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today, our class is honored to present the Suzanne L. Richardson Staff Appreciation Award to our very own Judith Merciano. Now, Judy, as she's known to us, is Director of Fellowships for OPIA, the Office of Public Interest Advising. Now, the nominations we received came from all sectors of the student population. And the stories that they told about Judy were all different personal interactions, but they all used the same words: enthusiastic, dedicated, resourceful. One student said, "I estimate that Judy has spent over 50 hours with me alone, and I'm just one of dozens." Another one remarked, "On any given evening, you'll likely see her staying up in her office well past midnight, answering emails, advocating on behalf of students." Quite simply, Judy Merciano is an amazing staff member. One classmate said it best: "Judy is hands down the most dedicated staff member I have encountered in my 3 years at Harvard Law School." Today, we honor you, Judy, for making service your passion and your profession. On behalf of the class of 2010 of Harvard Law School, we thank you for your service. Thank you.
Thank you. Congratulations, class of 2010. Thank you for this privilege of participating with you on class day. The Suzanne Richardson Award is very much a shared award. It honors the collaborative work of my Harvard Law School colleagues and your mentors, but it especially honors you. It honors your taking time out of your busy schedule from academic research and writing, clinical representation and practice, and professional and social activities to express gratitude. Indeed, it honors your families and friends who are with us or remembered today, and who both encouraged you to use the powerful gifts you have worked so hard to obtain and also imparted to you the admirable and enduring value of decency in thinking about others, especially in the toughest economic times. In my memory, you are one of the most cohesive classes to graduate from Harvard Law School. Like the law school crest with three bundles of wheat firmly tied near their foundations, you've spent your 3 years at Harvard creating ties that bring you together. Yet, like the splayed tops of the wheat, every summer you spread out in different parts of the globe. You help advance human rights in Zimbabwe, the Burmese border, and criminal tribunals, create programs for special needs students in Newark, advocate for environmental and civil rights on a national scale, protect academic freedoms in university council offices, and promote the rule of law in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Thailand, and numerous African nations. What then is the knot that ties your class together? I'm especially grateful for this award, as it is named after an individual who taught me much about cohesion and closeness. Suzanne Richardson, the former dean of students with whom my family and I were very close, had an uncanny ability to draw diverse people together. She helped support the dreams of Harvard Law School students from all over the world. And when she became ill, her hospital room was filled with Harvard professors, along with rock stars and ministers getting their JDs and LLMs. She was constantly surrounded by a heterogeneous group of people who came to see her to see in one another the qualities that she was grateful to see in them. Appreciation was the tie that bound them together. From my experience, you are the class of individuals who have shown the greatest gratitude in some of the toughest times. The speeches given today and the testaments regarding student experiences found in your class day programs all affirm how appreciative you are for one another, as well as for the law school dean, faculty, staff, and donors. Everyone stepping up to the plate was critical because this year's job and fellowship timing went into extra innings. Your gratitude and support for your classmates was evident throughout your years at Harvard Law School, from the way you interacted in study sessions at the Hark in student publications, productions, and bake sales, to your dedication to working together on behalf of others through law school clinics and negotiation workshops. Your collaborative efforts were advanced by mutual appreciation. I am thankful both for what you have done while at Harvard Law School, as well as for all that you are about to do. At commencement time, I sometimes get anxious and wonder if there's one more piece of advice or an entire list of items that I need to tell you before you go. I do not feel that way this year. I have the greatest confidence that this class will successfully combine its intellectual acumen and its compassionate care for others. Indeed, the list of projects you've already designed leave me breathless. Whether you are improving the lives of people in the Mississippi Delta, disabled clients in China, incarcerated individuals in New Orleans, juveniles and mothers in the Bronx, Harlem, or New Hampshire, whether you're working with foster kids in Pittsburgh, indigent adults in D.C., domestic violence victims in Roxbury, or on behalf of affordable housing and immigration rights in L.A., New York City, the Bay Area, the South, the Midwest, or even in our own backyard. Whether next year you will find you are enforcing homeland security above or under the water, making strides in cyberspace and child protection law in Australia, or rebuilding the economy and developing housing and corporations in major cities and communities around the U.S. Whether you will be promoting exciting new entrepreneurial ventures, such as BarMax, advancing academic careers, or assisting in judicial decision-making and clerkships, or engaging in policymaking and litigation on behalf of the government, or even if you have not yet found the job of your dreams, I know that you already are ready to contribute. To all of you, I am grateful. I'm grateful for your gratitude, which has not only made the class of 2010 an outstanding class, but will ultimately make this a better world. Congratulations, class of 2010.
It is my honor to present the Albert M. Sachs Paul A. Freund Award for Teaching Excellence to Professor Michael Klarman, the Kirkland & Ellis Professor of Law. After graduating from Stanford Law School, Professor Klarman began his legal career clerking for then-Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. In 1987, he joined the faculty of the University of Virginia School of Law, where he was named the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law, as well as the Elizabeth D. and Richard A. Merrill Research Professor and Professor of History. In 2008, he joined the Harvard faculty as a tenured professor. He is the author of several books and over 30 articles, including From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Racial Equality, which won the Bancroft Prize in 2005, widely considered to be the most prestigious award in American history writing. His scholarly work and teaching has garnered him several awards, including the first Roger and Madeline Traynor Faculty Achievement Award for Excellence in Legal Scholarship given by Virginia Law, the University of Virginia Harrison Achievement Award, the State Council of Higher Education Faculty Award, and the All-University Teaching Award, one of the university's highest honors for excellence in teaching, research, and service. Today, Professor Klarman adds another much-deserved honor to that distinguished list, an award that recognizes his exceptional teaching here at Harvard Law School. Students repeatedly express their amazement at Professor Klarman's friendly nature, brilliant mind, and genuine commitment to students outside of the classroom, supervising papers, reviewing case comments for journals, and speaking at student events, including the Class of 2010 lecture series this past spring. In office hours, he, quote, mixes academic discussion and insightful advice about future academic career planning with a warm friendliness that encourages students to speak with him. Sometimes, students can simply drop by to discuss a shared love of baseball. Of his intellectual prowess, students said, quote, Professor Klarman is a model teacher of law. In the classroom, he made constitutional law come alive through his insightful, rigorous, and well-organized analysis. End quote, his excellence in constitutional history is breathtaking. One student even went so far as to say, quote, if I were the president of the United States, Professor Klarman would be my first Supreme Court nominee. He is the liberal Scalia. This may mean he will not be on the Supreme Court, but at the very least, he should receive the Sachs-Frund Award for Teaching Excellence as a consolation prize. Professor Klarman, thank you for your unwavering dedication to your students. Congratulations on receiving the Albert M. Sachs Paul A. Frund Award for Teaching Excellence.
Thank you, Jessica. I'm deeply honored to receive the Sachs-Frund Teaching Award. It makes me almost as happy as the Red Sox coming back from a 3-0 deficit against the Yankees in 2004. Almost as happy. Seriously, this means a great deal to me. It's an honor that I'm sure I don't really deserve, but I am nonetheless very touched that you've chosen to bestow it upon me. Now, I'm pretty sure what I'm supposed to do today is say something either funny or inspirational. I don't do funny, at least not all that well. And what inspires me the most is baseball, and I'm pretty sure that's not what I'm supposed to talk about today, if for no other reason that some of you are Yankees fans and I have nothing inspirational or indeed particularly flattering to say to such creatures. So the best I could come up with was to tell you a few stories about a couple of lawyers who I've always found very inspirational, and I hope you will as well, Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, unfortunately, I'm a person of limited stories. Some of you have already heard at least some of these stories, so I'm afraid you're going to have to bear with me. The takeaway lesson, I think, if there is one, is that when you consider some of the obstacles that these people faced and overcame in their effort to make the world a better place, I think one comes to appreciate that people today who are committed to achieving social reform actually have things pretty easy, so there's much less excuse for us failing to even make the effort. So let me start with Thurgood Marshall, and then I'll move on and say a few words about Justice Ginsburg. It's useful, I think, to begin by thinking about what difficulties ordinary lawyers face when they bring a lawsuit. Client brings a case to you, you go out and you investigate the facts, you study the law to see how it applies to your case, then you use the facts and existing law to try to marshal the best argument you can on behalf of your client. Things were so much more difficult and complicated for civil rights lawyers like Thurgood Marshall. One obstacle that he faced that ordinary lawyers don't is the threat and reality of physical violence. Black civil rights lawyers in the South were challenging a deeply entrenched status quo, one that many, indeed most whites, were resistant to changing, indeed often fiercely resistant. In some parts of the South, you have to remember the culture of extralegal violence, which had resulted in 100 lynchings a year as late as the 1890s, was only beginning to dissipate quite recently. Often African Americans had been lynched for conduct far less insurrectionary than simply bringing a lawsuit challenging school segregation. Even as late as the 1940s and 1950s, some African Americans engaged in civil rights protests were killed for what they were doing, and a great many others were beaten or maimed. For example, when World War II veteran Etoy Fletcher tried to register to vote in rural Mississippi in 1946, the registrar informed him, according to a letter that Fletcher sent to the NAACP, quote, "Niggers are not allowed to vote in Rankin County, and if you don't want to get into serious trouble, get out of this building," close quote. While he was waiting for a bus out of town, Fletcher was assaulted by four whites who drove him several miles into the woods, beat and flogged him mercilessly, and warned him that he would be killed if he ever again tried to register to vote in Mississippi. In Montgomery County, Georgia, also in 1946, a man named D.V. Carter organized an NAACP branch, which consisted mostly of farmers and sharecroppers and was principally devoted to voter registration. Several hundred African Americans registered to vote as a result of his efforts. After ignoring repeated warnings from the KKK to desist, Carter was severely beaten. Isaac Newton, who Carter had convinced to register to vote, was murdered. An all-white jury acquitted the two white men who were accused of killing him. And it wasn't just prospective black voters and civil rights demonstrators who faced the threat and reality of physical violence. Civil rights lawyers did as well. Thurgood Marshall was himself nearly lynched in 1946 while he was representing black defendants who were being prosecuted for their actions growing out of the Columbia, Tennessee race riot. Other NAACP lawyers, one in Nashville, one in Birmingham, had their homes bombed in the early 1960s because they brought school desegregation lawsuits. Another problem that black civil rights lawyers faced was the racial prejudice of judges and juries, all of whom in the South, at least at this time, were still white. When black NAACP lawyers argued cases before the Fifth Circuit in the 1930s, challenging race discrimination in voting, the judges on the bench literally turned their backs to the lawyers, not willing even to acknowledge their presence. In correspondence with the NAACP's national office, these lawyers wondered whether it even made sense to turn up for oral argument, given that only an appeal to the United States Supreme Court held out any hope of success. Yet the Supreme Court itself wasn't always the most hospitable environment for civil rights lawyers. Justice James McReynolds, who my students in the audience will immediately recognize as the worst human being ever to sit on the United States Supreme Court, James McReynolds likewise turned his back on Charles Hamilton Houston when he argued the Gaines case in 1938, challenging the exclusion of African Americans from higher education in the state of Missouri. Can you imagine such a thing? Charles Houston was a graduate of Harvard Law School. He was a protege of Felix Frankfurter. He was a brilliant lawyer. He was the dean of Howard Law School, and Justice James McReynolds literally turned his back on him. There's another important point to appreciate about the job these civil rights lawyers did. We think of lawyers as people who argue cases in court. But in some ways, the most important job of these African-American civil rights lawyers took place outside the courtroom. These lawyers went into Southern black communities and they tried to teach people, many of whom were still illiterate, few of whom had any conception of what the Constitution said, that they had rights and that those rights had to be respected by white people. Black civil rights lawyers such as Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston saw part of their role as mobilizing Southern blacks to fight against an oppressive status quo, encouraging them to believe that progressive racial change was indeed possible, boosting their morale by demonstrating to them that an outside organization cared about their interests and was committed to helping them overcome obstacles that must sometimes have seemed insurmountable barriers to social change. Houston, who was the NAACP's chief litigator in the 1930s, saw a principal goal of the litigation campaign as, quote, arousing and strengthening the will of local communities to demand and fight for their rights. Thurgood Marshall's biographer, my colleague Mark Tushnet, writes of Marshall being brought to town ostensibly, quote, to work on pending litigation, but actually to rally the troops. In a letter to Marshall, Houston referred to himself as, quote, not only lawyer, but as evangelist and stump speaker. The NAACP recognized the beneficial psychological effects that using African American lawyers could have on local black communities. Southern blacks were not accustomed to seeing black people stand up to whites on a footing of equality or challenge what white people said. But an African American lawyer in court could, for example, accuse a white sheriff of lying when he denied beating a black defendant into confessing. Such performances had an enormous impact on black audiences in the courtroom. Here's how Thurgood Marshall described what happened in a courtroom in Hugo, Oklahoma in early 1941 as he defended a black man named Lyons for murder charges that may well have been concocted. Lyons had been beaten into confessing, a fact that Marshall was trying to get the sheriff and his deputies to admit under cross-examination. Now, Marshall and his co-counsel, who was a white ACLU lawyer, had agreed that Marshall would cross-examine all the police officers because, according to Marshall, quote, we figured they would resent being questioned by a Negro and would get angry, and this would help us. It worked perfect. They all became angry at the idea of a Negro pushing them into tight corners and making their lies so obvious. Boy, did I like that. And did the Negroes in the courtroom like it. You can't imagine what it means to those people down there who have been pushed around for years to know that there's an organization that will help them. They are really ready to do their part now. They are ready for anything. So it's important to emphasize that for African American civil rights lawyers in the South, the organizational, motivational, educational, and role modeling parts of the job were as important as coming up with winning legal arguments in court. Now, the same was true of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who headed the Women's Rights Project of the ACLU in the 1970s. She, too, saw her role as encompassing much more than being a lawyer in court. She lobbied legislatures in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment, and she wrote letters to ACLU affiliates across the country, advising them about their legal priorities and informing them in developments in other states. She also saw educating the public about sex discrimination as a vital part of her job. When her female law students lobbied for a course on sex discrimination in the late 1960s, Ginsburg put one together from scratch. Then she authored the nation's first casebook on gender in the law, and she actively encouraged law schools around the country to teach such a course. She also maintained a constant stream of correspondence with student law review editors, urging them to write about recent sex discrimination cases, educating them about the issues involved, and providing them with briefs and other materials to enhance their scholarship. In addition, she wrote letters to the New York Times and other journals, encouraging them to cover sex discrimination cases and correcting mistakes they made when their coverage went awry. Ginsburg was an organizer, a mobilizer, a publicist, and an educator for the sex equality movement, just as Thurgood Marshall had been for the civil rights movement a generation earlier. Now, Ginsburg had to overcome some formidable obstacles to get where she ultimately did. Her life story nicely illustrates what the professional world was like for women 50 years ago. If you think Mad Men, you're not going to go too far from the right path. Her story also illustrates how much that world has changed since then and how much is possible for a dedicated lawyer to contribute to such social change. Ginsburg entered Harvard Law School in 1956. She was one of 9 women in a class of over 500. Early in the year, Dean Irvin Griswold had the women over to his house for dinner, and during the course of the evening, he asked them why they wanted to be at HLS, taking up the spot of a man who presumably could put his legal education to better use. Ginsburg, unprepared for the question, said something like, "Well, it's important for a woman to be informed about her husband's profession." Her spouse, Marty Ginsburg, was a year ahead of her at Harvard Law School. In 1956, nobody could have been confident that a woman would ever sit on the United States Supreme Court. After 2 years at Harvard, Ginsburg wanted to transfer to Columbia for her third year after her husband had graduated, taken a job with a New York law firm, and they had a very young child and didn't want to split up the family. Harvard refused to allow her to transfer for her third year and still receive a Harvard degree, a decision that I'm sure you can imagine the school has much regretted over the past 50 years. Though HLS has several times offered Justice Ginsburg a Harvard degree, she has yet to accept it, though I'm delighted to report that she does not hold it against prospective law clerks. Encourage you all to apply for the job. It's important that you keep in mind being a baseball fan is a negative qualification in her mind. She loves the opera. She doesn't understand why any sentient being would be a sports fan. Her loss, nobody's perfect. When Ginsburg graduated from Columbia in 1959, she was tied for first in her class, and she was a member. She had membership in both the law reviews at Harvard and Columbia. Her professors tried to get her a federal clerkship, which she was eminently qualified for, but no federal judge in the New York City area would hire a young mother as a law clerk. Finally, one of her professors, Gerald Gunther, got a federal district judge named Palmieri to hire Ginsburg by offering a personal guarantee that if she did not work out, he would find a male law school graduate to take her place. She worked out so well that Palmieri eagerly hired female clerks in succeeding years. Ginsburg tells a great story about how she got her first job in legal academia. Rutgers had no women on its faculty, like most law schools in the early 1960s, but they had an African American, which was also pretty rare at the time. When he left to become dean at another law school, Rutgers wanted to replace him with another African American. Not finding one to their liking, they hired a white woman instead. African American and female professors were equally curiosities in those days and apparently were seen as essentially fungible commodities. Ginsburg overcame such barriers to become in 1970 the first tenured woman ever hired at Columbia Law School. That same year, she helped found the Women's Rights Project of the ACLU. She argued 6 landmark cases in the United States Supreme Court in the 1970s, winning 5 of them. The elderly male justices before whom she argued these cases sometimes treated sex discrimination with a frivolity with which they would never have treated race discrimination at that time. After concluding an oral argument in a case challenging a state law that provided for jury service on different terms for men and women, one justice joked from the bench, "So then, you won't accept having Susan B. Anthony on the dollar." If you've got a good response to that one, then Harvard has taught you very well in your oral advocacy skills. What in the world are you supposed to say when a justice asks you that? Other justices privately referred to her briefs as emotional and recorded the color of the clothing Ginsburg wore during her oral arguments, once again illustrating how deeply ingrained were the very sex stereotypes that she was trying to get the court to strike down. She preferred red, by the way, if you're interested. Ginsburg frequently received phone calls at her office about her son James, who was then about 10, who was acting up at school. This is another one of my favorite stories, and after this I'll release you. It's so hot, it's cruel to go on much longer. James was about 10, he was acting up at school. Ginsburg at this time, you realize, was a tenured professor at Columbia. She was spending a great deal of time traveling around the country, lobbying for the ERA, arguing cases in the Supreme Court. But she finally, after these phone calls continued for a while, she got exasperated, and she said in reply to one of the calls from school, quote, "This child has 2 parents. I suggest from now on that you alternate between them when you need to speak to someone about James." Ginsburg reports that even though James's behavior did not materially improve, the phone calls ended because the school would not dream of bothering a busy male tax attorney during his office hours. So to sum up, civil rights lawyers like Marshall, women's rights lawyers like Ginsburg were up against a lot. Marshall faced the threat and reality of physical violence, as well as deeply prejudiced judges and jurors. When he left the Supreme Court building after conducting the oral argument in Brown versus Board of Education, there were very few places in Washington, D.C. where a black man could get a bite to eat. Ginsburg went to law school at a time when women lawyers were widely ridiculed. She couldn't get the fancy clerkship she had so richly earned. She only got a job in law teaching as a sort of curiosity. The justices before whom she challenged sex discrimination did not always take her arguments very seriously, and being steeped in the very same sex stereotypes she was asking them to eradicate, they often had a hard time even comprehending how the statute she was challenging actually harmed women. Marshall and Ginsburg overcame their respective obstacles. They helped organize movements for social reform. They educated people about their rights. They encouraged them to believe that the status quo was not inevitable, and they inspired followers by modeling behavior that contravened the very stereotypes that help entrench the status quo. Fittingly, many years later, each took his or her place on the United States Supreme Court, thus demonstrating through their own lives that profound social reform is indeed possible, that it can happen more quickly than most people would ever have imagined, and that bold, hardworking, and dedicated lawyers can play an instrumental role in bringing it about. Good luck to all of you in your budding legal careers, and do us proud, as we know you will. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Martha Minow, and I have the privilege of being the dean here at the Harvard Law School. I promise I'm not going to give a speech. I have a much sweeter task here today, which is to honor some people. To state, but then question, the obvious is a familiar wonder of legal education. So here we are on class day. What does that mean? I suggest it is the day that we honor class acts. And I looked it up in the dictionary. A class act is defined as having distinctive and superior quality, or better yet, impressive and stylish elegance. We salute the graduating class for your hard work, your accomplishments in classrooms, clinics, journals, organizations, lunchrooms, where there's conversations as well as eating, performances, moot court, and other competitions, your contributions to making the school and the profession itself vibrant, sharp, and promising. I thank Harold Hope for his leadership of the Harvard Law School Alumni Association and for welcoming the pre-alums who are here today. With the leadership of the class marshals selected by the class itself, we also on this day honor those that this accomplished class has chosen to honor. In so doing, we celebrate extraordinary individuals and also lift up the judgment, values, and taste of the class itself. For in choosing those you honor, you define yourselves. By choosing Judy Murciano, the class of 2010 elevates selfless devotion, visionary service to those who seek to serve others, and superhuman stamina and persuasiveness in catapulting so many students into the fellowships that launch their dreams. In choosing the unbelievably amazing Michael Klarman for the Teaching Award, the class of 2010 shows itself to overcome its prejudices against the Red Sox and the Celtics, but also to appreciate analytical rigor and the kind of arresting argumentation that makes us rethink seemingly settled views about what law and politics really do and accomplish. In picking my dear friend Samantha Power, the class of 2010 for its Class Day speaker, reveals its keenness for conscience, for marrying passion with relentless pursuit of truth and analysis, for justice and gutsiness. I can't wait to hear what Samantha has come here to say today. I have the distinct honor to announce individuals of the class's own ranks, selected for special commendation, reflecting the judgment of the peers as well as input from staff and faculty. I start with the Righeimer Prize, which is awarded annually to one graduating student in recognition of exceptional citizenship within the law school community. Faculty, staff, and students submitted nominations for the Righeimer Prize, and I'm pleased to announce that this year's recipient is Erica Rickard. Erica, your outstanding contributions to the law school community as a leader, as a mentor, and as an advocate for students here and for others make it an honor to honor you. You contributed to the academic life and scholarship in the school through your work on two journals, Harvard Human Rights Journal and the Journal of Law and Gender. As the stage manager and technical director of the Drama Society, you helped to keep the law school laughing. Your leadership of Lambda has been tremendous, particularly in overseeing a remarkable conference on international legal approaches affecting sexual orientation discrimination. Your work on behalf of the admissions office, particularly your participation in student life panels during admitted student weekends, helped convince future classmates here to choose Harvard Law School. And in addition, your passion for justice manifested in your work alongside child laborers in India, your advocacy work for tenants and juveniles in our court systems have made an enormous impact beyond the walls of the school. As one of your nominators described you so well, you are, and I quote, that rare student at HLS who gives her time and energy to things that go beyond her own ambitions. Please join me in congratulating Erica.
Thank you so much, Dean Minow, for this wonderful honor, the Frank Righeimer Jr. Award for Student Citizenship. I come from Arizona, so I cannot tell you how grateful I am that I now have undeniable proof of my citizenship. I'm keeping it in my car. More importantly, I'm so proud to be a citizen of the class of 2010, a community of remarkable character and more than our fair share of remarkable characters. I have met some truly amazing people at this law school. In fact, I met the love of my life here. And I hope the same for each and every one of you. You have approximately 24 hours. I think you can make it happen. But whether it's the people we love or our friends or even our nemeses, together, we have shaped what it means to be Harvard Law School. We make this place the rich, vibrant community that it is just by being ourselves and by bringing the things that we care about here. From the fundraising dinners for Darfur to the many, many celebrations of the Jersey Shore, that variety is what makes HLS so great. Every person's contribution has made us brighter and prouder and closer. And now is not the time to forget those great personal qualities that you've brought to this law school. Yesterday, we were the citizens of this community, but tomorrow, all those lights come spilling out and we become citizens of the world. And the world needs our best. The world needs you to be yourself. So, as we leave these hallowed halls of Pound and Gropius, let's remember what we have to offer, who we are, and what we care about. Bring your personality, bring your integrity, bring your own moral judgment to the legal profession. And class of 2010, please bring your dashing good looks. Because I truly believe that if nothing else, the class of 2010 will go down in history as the best looking class Harvard Law School has ever known. Thank you so much.
I'm really excited to be able to now to present the Dean's Awards for Community Leadership. We talk about this as an institution, but an institution is just a fancy name for a group of people. And the people who enrich this community through academic excellence, public service, creative vision, and just darn goodness are amazing. They're nominations submitted by faculty, staff, and students. These students, whom I will name, exemplify Harvard Law School at its best. I'm going to call a bunch of names. This is a test for the audience. I'm going to call 14 names. I'm not asking you to applaud until all 14 are there. Let's see if you can do this. When I call a name, I'm challenging those whose name I call to do another difficult thing, which is to stand up. So Randall Thomas Adams, Randy, or shall I say Mr. Civil Rights and Liberties, not only did you serve as president of Harvard Law School's American Constitutional Society, you coordinated the programming of 155 American Constitution Society chapters in 47 states. Your work for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and for the Harvard AIDS Coalition, for the Harvard Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law Review, and the Harvard Law and Policy Review would seem to fill every possible minute of the day, and yet you also found time to entertain your classmates and teachers with the parody. And on top of that, you're here today as class marshal. Brian Taylor Oney. You began as a student advocate, and then you made the role of president of student government that of student advocate par excellence. Your classmates report that you have made the HLS community a better place by listening, by advocating, and by making things change day to day. This award also recognizes your work on the Harvard Law and Policy Review and the Harvard Journal of Legislation, where your talents honed legal arguments analysis. And this award honors your wife, whom you married 3 years ago to this day. Why she married someone entering the Harvard Law School, I don't know, and that's why she gets to share the award with you. David K. Baumgarten. David, your dedication to sound mind in sound bodies was manifest in your leadership of more intramural sports than I frankly knew existed. You are known as the commish. As you manage the basketball and flag football leagues for the law school, you serve as president of the HLS Softball Club. Your classmates credit you with turning fun extracurricular activities into catalysts for community. It may be why this is the best looking class after all. And you also help people develop lifelong friendships. You mentored 1L through your work on the Board of Student Advisors, Mr. Kamish. Daryl Jane Bennett Jr. Daryl, as Vice President of the Black Law Students Association, you produced super social activities, and you also chaired the BALSA Recruitment Committee. Class Marshall, Resident Assistant, member of the Green Living Committee, you're a leader in every domain. And as bailiff for the Ames Moot Court Competition, you are unsurpassed. The Harvard International Law Journal editorship also is one of your accomplishments, and you have made law come to life. David Fatui. David, your presidency of the Federalist Society reflected the respect of students in one of the largest campus organizations. You have given vital voice to principles of libertarian and conservative direction, but your supporters on this campus come from every quarter. They celebrate the way you organized the simply largest number of co-sponsored events in your organization's history. Really remarkable. The engagement so enriched the intellectual fabric of this community and, even more importantly, modeled your own extraordinary capacity to draw on clarity about your own principles while promoting rich and respectful interaction with those who have other views. As editor and then senior editor of the Journal of Law and Public Policy, as an active contributor to the weekly Record, boy, I always love reading what you say, you make these two vital centers for debate and community. Brittany Ann Hall, editor of the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology, student attorney at the Harvard Legal Aid Bureau, which is itself a full-time job. Your classmates celebrate especially your ability to ensure balance and fun in student life through your work as class marshal and as officer of HL Central. E.B. Kelly, you served as president of the Board of Student Advisors in a way that ensured fabulous teaching and advising of first-year students with a spirit that combined professionalism and joy. But your talents benefited not only first-year students and the BSA team because of your work as policy editor of the Harvard Law and Policy Review, as co-chair of the Real Estate Association, as leader of the Forum on Local Government. I don't know how you do it all. Elaine Lin, one of my best days as dean this year came when I opened an unexpected letter of heartfelt thanks from the Nantucket firefighters for the negotiation and conflict management training that you organized for them and for union members and town administrators through your work as advanced training director for the Harvard Mediation Program and chair of Harvard Negotiators. You led similar efforts to equip newly elected African-American officials in the Mississippi Delta and the World Business Dialogue in Cologne, Germany. And somehow you also found time to edit the Executive Digest for the International Law Journal and to row for the Harvard Law School Women's Crew Team. Amazing. Stephanie Marie Matthews, your leadership running the Ames Moot Court Competition made it the single most successful and effective competition in the history of the organization, which, as you know, is almost 100 years long. You set a new standard for excellence in every step of the process while also invigorating the Journal of Law and Public Policy and the Women's Law Association. Jessica Eve Nachman, your class keeps electing you. You've been elected representative 3 times, a student government representative. You've been elected a member of the 2L Social Committee and now 3L Class Marshal. What is your secret? Tell me later. And all the while, you served as article editor for the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology and a member of the Board of Student Advisors. Mark Benjamin Sandberg. From the most serious to the most fun, you worked as case assignment director for Harvard Defenders, board member from the Harvard Journal of Legislation and Harvard Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review, and you stretched yourself and our own funny boons through Statler and Waldorf, Harvard Law School's own improv comedy troupe. Anne Rennell Siders, we salute you as editor-in-chief for the Human Rights Law Journal and founder and editor-in-chief of the National Security Journal. You researched climate change. You researched and worked on landmine reform in London. You studied abuses in the Singaporean defamation law against freedom of expression, and all the while performed with other singers in the Scales of Justice and in the troupe of the HLS Drama Society. Nima Devendra Tavinde, there you are. You served as president of the South Asian Law Students Association, as a member of the Board of Student Advisors, as a chair of the BSA Selection Committee, as a member of the Prison Legal Assistance Program and editor of the Journal of Law and Gender, and you organized a trip for your classmates to Mumbai that they will never forget, nor will they forget you. And Dominique Danelle Winters. Dominique, your dedication to equal protection under the law led you to crisscross this country. You were outreach director for Harvard Defenders. You worked on a murder case in the DC Public Defender's Office. You assisted the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta. Your amazing leadership as president of the Black Students Law Association guided not only people here on campus, but also alumni and members of the broader community. You also served as president and ABA outreach coordinator for the Student Bar Association, and you dazzled as a member of the HLS trial team and the BALSA trial team. Audience, that's 14. It's your cue. I have three more special awards to announce. The David Westfall Memorial Dean's Award is given each year in memory of a beloved professor, Professor David Westfall. David Westfall taught at this law school for more than 50 years until shortly before he died in 2006. He so loved students, and students loved him. At an age when others would have been contemplating retirement, he enthusiastically volunteered to lead 1L sections, and in so doing, he hosted more dinners and social events than all the other sections combined. In the words of one of his students, he helped to take this place with a grain of salt and a smile. We honor the memory of this popular and devoted teacher by recognizing students who made significant contributions, particularly to the first year section and class. And this year's David Westfall Memorial Dean's Award goes to Deborah Beth Rosenbaum. Deborah, there you are, good. So Debbie, here's what your section mates say about you. They say that you build community like nobody knows how to do. You united your section, this is a quote, with food. There were repeated mentions of baked goods. Got to get some recipes, as well as some other themes like the whiteout days where everybody had to wear white to class, and the costumes on Halloween. People will never forget that. You made HLS a warm, human, welcoming place, hard to imagine, and your section an inclusive, inviting world. One of your classmates explained a variety of small gestures can turn section mates into lifelong friends, and that's what you did. Congratulations, Debbie. And finally, it's a genuine honor for me and distinctive delight to announce the two winners of the Andrew L. Kaufman Pro Bono Service Award, which is granted each year in honor of Associate Dean and Professor Andy Kaufman, who is truly the instrumental creator and supporter of our pro bono service program here at the law school. This is an award given to the JD student who performs the highest number of hours of pro bono volunteer service. This year we had two. We just couldn't deny the fact that two actually broke all records. The Office of Clinical and Pro Bono Programs determines the winner based on numbers of total hours submitted by the students. And the winners of this award each performed, are you ready? Over 2,500 pro bono hours each. First, Julia Hildreth. You served the Harvard Legal Aid Bureau, the Tenant Advocacy Project as co-chair. You organized a pro bono trip to the Public Defender Service of the District of Columbia, one of my favorites, Kids in Court. The Prison Legal Assistance Project, the No One Leaves Project, which is keeping people in their homes here in Massachusetts, despite foreclosure. And your summers at Children's Rights in New York and Brock's Defenders rounded out the story. Julia, you're amazing. Mark Sandberg. Your activities include Harvard Defenders, Criminal Justice Institute Clinic, Capital Punishment Clinical, with two semesters with the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, as a pro bono researcher for Professor Steiker on capital defense cases, a pro bono researcher for Professor Jim Greiner, examining the racial composition of jury veneers, and you started the pro bono research arm of the Journal on Legislation, something we never had before. You spent your summers at the New Haven Public Defender and the Public Defender Services of the District of Columbia. You each are class acts, and I commend you and the acts of your class commending you. Get that. Now, I get to introduce Randall Thomas Adams once again, as he has the privilege of introducing our 2010 Class Day speaker. Randy?
Each year, the graduating class invites a distinguished guest to share some remarks with us on Class Day. And today, it is my privilege to introduce Samantha Power as our 2010 Class Day speaker. Ms. Power knows something about graduating from Harvard Law School because she did so herself in 1999. But she arrived here already a seasoned war correspondent, having covered the wars in the former Yugoslavia for publications like U.S. News and World Report, the Boston Globe, and the New Republic. While in law school, Ms. Power wrote a paper on American responses to 20th century genocide. This paper received a P, but unlike is the case for most of us, this P stood for Pulitzer. The book that paper eventually turned into, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and a Council on Foreign Relations Prize. In addition, that book, along with Ms. Power's further reporting in publications like The New Yorker, is widely credited with really helping getting the world's attention on the genocide in Darfur. Additionally, Ms. Power has continued to report from all over the world, from places like East Timor, Rwanda, Zimbabwe. Back here in Cambridge, she founded the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government, where she serves as the Anna Lind Professor of Practice of Global Leadership and Public Policy. Her second book, Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, was published last year and is the basis for the documentary Sergio, which premiered on HBO earlier this month. In 2005, Ms. Power left Harvard to work as a fellow in the offices of the newly elected senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, class of 91, and she served as a senior advisor to his presidential campaign. Today, Ms. Power continues to advise the president and serve her country as a special assistant to the president and senior director for multilateral affairs and human rights at the National Security Council. So we are thrilled today to have Ms. Power, whose career has had such remarkable achievement in areas like journalism, academia, and government. And her life and work really shows us the power of ideas and persuasion to spur action, the reward for taking risks in our careers, and just how much you can do with an HLS degree and a commitment to justice. It is my honor to welcome to the podium a genuine American public intellectual, Ms. Samantha Power.
Hi there. Graduating students, parents, it's been a while. Can we get a big shout out for the parents and the step parents here today? Stepfathers, stepmothers, mothers, fathers. It goes without saying that none of us would be here without you, literally. And I am personally more than a little humbled to be up here during your commencement festivities, to be surrounded by this ferociously talented faculty and these unbelievable students that you've been hearing about. No longer students, actually, graduates. One sign of how seriously I take this assignment is that I've actually invited my parents to your commencement, which is maybe a little pathetic. Thank you so much for having me, again, graduates and Dean Minow. Dean Minow, that has such a nice ring to it. Elena Kagan is a very, very tough act to follow, but Harvard Law School could not have made a better choice in choosing Professor Minow. She has many, many virtues, but the one that I cherish most is the way that she unfailingly treats students as peers. Each of you who have taken her classes or engaged her on law, politics, geopolitics, or your personal lives know what I'm talking about. And I can say from experience that when you look into Dean Minow's eyes, the reflection you see of yourself is the person you hope you can become. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn." The Minow stamp on this law school will be an involved student body, involved in learning, involved in tailoring what is taught, and involved in shaping the world beyond the ivory tower. Congratulations, Dean Minow, on a stellar first year as Dean of Harvard Law School. In the old days, before I went into government, I gave a few commencement addresses, and I enjoyed them a lot. Now I'm in the Obama administration, and there's a risk that something I say here today will be associated with a certain other Harvard Law School graduate who's my boss. I talked to a senior White House official about this speech and told him that I was half dreading doing it because in my current job, I couldn't actually say anything. And he said, "Sure you can." And I said, "Well, no, I know I can, but I just can't say anything interesting." And he said, "No, Samantha, you just can't say anything controversial." And I said, "Well, unfortunately with me, those are kind of concentric, overlapping circles, but maybe it's like a Venn diagram where there might be this tiny sliver of space where, and I got to find it here today, that is both non-controversial and interesting, and that's the sliver of space I'm going to seek to find here, and you'll know in about 15 minutes whether I have succeeded. My husband, Cass Sunstein, is here with me today. Many of you have made use of his constitutional law or administrative law casebook. Luckily, when I took con law here with Larry Tribe, I didn't use Professor Sunstein's casebook. If I had, I actually don't think it would have been appropriate for me to date him. Dating somebody whose casebook you have used would have crossed into what my girlfriends and I call heebie-jeebie territory. But I will tell you this, I would trade every last Ivy League degree for just a single day with Cass as a companion. This audience is filled with overachievers. This is not a revelation. You can spot an overachiever early. Overachievers wear such heavy backpacks in elementary school that no hurricane could topple them as they wait at the bus stop. Overachievers take so many Kaplan LSAT practice tests that Kaplan actually runs out of sample questions. Overachievers have great trouble starting a book but not finishing it. After all, the point is less the content of the book than the act of turning the final page. Overachievers study right up until the last minute, genuinely believing that the extra 5 minutes of reviewing a civil procedure outline will make all the difference. Most overachievers care more about their grades than their sex lives, though there may be a few here who strive for overachieving in all domains. Overachievers were once those who tutored in low-income school districts, but now, in the 21st century, they are those who sneak across the border into Burma and actually build schools from scratch. Overachievers, unfortunately, often risk their lives by doing work on their BlackBerries while driving. Graduates, if you hear nothing else today, please don't text and drive. If Cass and I are any indicator, overachievers watch the Olympics in middle age and fantasize about taking up curling, because it looks like the one sport we can still win an Olympic medal in. There's way too much recognition in that laughter in this audience. Overachievers don't like failing, and they do like winning. Overachievers often have a hole in their psyche, and achievement is their way of filling that hole. As my favorite singer Leonard Cohen likes to say, "There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." I gather from my mother, who is here today, as I mentioned, that the first sign I was determined to become an overachiever came early. She had grown up in County Cork, Ireland, and had moved temporarily to England. In 1975, she was simultaneously playing world-class squash, attending medical school, and trying to complete her PhD in biochemistry. Scary. And all this while, she was taking care of a tiny, redheaded, demanding daughter. I always thought my mother was extraordinary, but now that I have a tiny, redheaded, demanding 1-year-old son, I literally marvel at how she did all she did. Well, this PhD of hers took years to complete, and finally one day she brought it to the printers to get it bound. In those days, there were no Kinkos on every corner, so when you turned something into the printers, you were making a permanent commitment. When she picked it up, she was elated. This was a very, very big deal. Her 300-page-plus treatise had acquired this splendid blue binder. The dissertation was a monument to close to a half decade of work and passion. She laid it out on the kitchen table so she could turn it in the next day to her academic supervisor, and she went to bed content. But when my mother woke up on her big day, her overachiever 5-year-old had struck. Emblazoned on the front of what had been the immaculate blue cover of her bound dissertation were words scrawled in bright orange crayon. Samantha Power did this. Again, way too much recognition. When I wrote my book, A Problem from Hell, my mother actually described it as my second book. Now that I'm in my late 30s rather than my pre-kindergarten years, my sense of what counts as real achievement, I confess, has evolved. I'm still an overachiever of a certain sort, but now I look at the ring on Cass's finger or my infant son splashing around in the bath, and I say, wow, how did Samantha Power do that? My memories of this place are fond. It was the last pure oasis of thought unmediated by politics that I have inhabited. I came to Cambridge, as was mentioned, straight from a war zone. I'd been a journalist in Bosnia in the early 1990s. So the conventional stresses of HLS seemed mild in comparison. But I felt a different kind of vulnerability, as if the qualities that had served me in other environments did me no good here. As 1Ls, we were taught that right and wrong was less important than the quality of one's argument. And since I didn't know how to make good legal arguments, I was not at the top of my game. How many of you got through law school without experiencing your awful paper chase moment? Well, I very nearly escaped. It was not until the first day of my final semester here at Harvard Law School, the spring of my third year, long past the time I should have learned to think like a lawyer, when I heard those feared words out of my professor's mouth, "Ms. Power, will you kindly state the case?" I nearly died. I'd survived the siege of Sarajevo, but my heart raced, my tummy somersaulted, and a voice inside my head tried to soothe me. This can't be worse than Slobodan Milosevic. This can't be worse than Slobodan Milosevic. But it was. The case was Spalding versus Zimmerman, and mercifully, I had read it. Back in the 1950s, there'd been a car accident. A guy called John Zimmerman had rear-ended a 20-year-old named David Spalding. Spalding's ribs were broken, and he suffered some internal bleeding in the head. He sued Zimmerman for damages. Fairly straightforward. But controversy arose when Zimmerman, the bad driver, contracted a doctor to examine Spalding in order to gauge the gravity of his injuries. The doctor detected an aortal aneurysm that might rupture and cause Spalding, the person who'd been rear-ended, cause his death. Spalding was oblivious to his condition. Only Zimmerman and his lawyer possessed the vital, life-saving information. My ethics professor asked me whether Zimmerman's lawyer had a duty to disclose what he knew of Spalding's medical condition, when non-disclosure could result in severe harm. I was confused by this question. I looked around at my classmates, assuming that they too would be surprised by the professor's line of inquiry, but they seemed unflustered. I said simply, we're talking about an aneurysm. Yes, I'm aware of that, Ms. Power, but what should the defendant's lawyer do? The professor asks. I said, pardon me? It's an aneurysm. Yes, we've all read the case, the professor continued, but what should the defendant's lawyer do? I was totally confused. If Zimmerman's lawyer doesn't tell Spalding, Spalding might die, I said. By this time, virtually every hand in the class had shot up into the sky. Everyone understood the grave fallacy of my thinking. If Zimmerman's lawyer disclosed Spalding's medical condition, think of the spillover effects. What defendant would ever trust his lawyer again? How would our system of justice fare if a defense lawyer privileged the needs of the plaintiff over those of the defendant, who, after all, was not necessarily responsible for the aneurysm? What I had long suspected to be true was now official in my third year. I was structurally incapable of fully thinking like a lawyer. But while that aspect of thinking like a lawyer didn't stick, I did learn two very, very big things here. And I think it's true of the graduates as well. I wouldn't be surprised. I think every HLS grad gained here an ability to argue better. Now, all the parents in the audience are going to protest. They will tell tales of your pre-verbal, pig-headed toddler selves that indicate that you were serving up good arguments before you were weaned off diapers. Many of you have probably always been the advocate in your family. But parents, siblings, you think it was bad before they came to Harvard Law School when you were growing up with these people? Just wait. Have you argued with them lately? Not a lot of fun. The graduates of 2010 have built on already formidable foundations and gained literally daunting powers of argumentation. Where once their emotions might have stood in the way, this place has taught them to channel those emotions so that they can parse and rebut arguments with a clinical coldness that can be devastatingly effective. HLS grads, as you head out into the world, you actually have to be careful with this scalpel that this place has helped you sharpen. Like any scalpel, its incisions can cause severe bleeding. But like any medical scalpel, it can also help heal those in need, right many wrongs, and end a whole lot of pain out there. Reason is the tool that this place has given you, but justice is the cause that must lie within you. A regard for the welfare of others simply can't be taught. I have not practiced law, but I have used what I learned here in every article I've ever written, every cause I've advocated for. I use my law school education every day in government, anticipating the other side's argument, mobilizing facts, and presenting my own oral case. I don't always win, and sometimes the pre-law school me bubbles up and my underlying convictions show, but I am far better, I hope, at what I do because I stopped here along the way. The other thing we got from this place is an admiration, I think, even a reverence for the sturdy majesty of law itself. When I arrived on campus, most of my classmates couldn't put a finger on why they were attending law school. They said things like, I got in. I wanted to create options. Tough job market. You can't beat the credential. Rarely, if ever, at the start, did we hear much about law itself. But by the end of 3 years, most of us had come to understand that whatever motivated us to come here, law offered its own rewards. Law is the foundation for what President Roosevelt called freedom from fear and want, freedom from physical danger, and freedom from threats to one's property and one's dignity. Law is the one recourse the vulnerable through history have had against those who bullied them. Law today reflects the contributions and wisdom of countless people over time. In societies like ours, which are endowed with imperfect but durable legal systems, as the old saying goes, law is the wise restraint that makes men free. Of course, law's application and law's effects depend upon the determination and judgment of those of us privileged to be its caretakers. 2/3 of you will work in a law firm next year. 1/5 of you will take up clerkships, and 10% of you will work in government or public service. You will end up the Williams and Connolly associate, the lawyer in the city district attorney's office, the Texas public defender, the intellectual property lawyer, the rural family court judge, the legal blogger, the Tulane law professor, the local, state, or federal government official. Maybe you'll even end up writing fiction like Scott Turow. Regardless, it's in your hands to decide whether law will be enforced, whether law will be just, whether law will be used to slow or speed the spread of liberty and equality. It's on you, graduates, to decide whether law will do what it has done so often. In the words of the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney, make hope and history rhyme. As a non-practicing lawyer, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you how to use your law degree. I am no authority on these matters. But I can offer 4 simple tips that don't appear in the overachiever manual that you can pick up at the Harvard Coop. The first, never compare your insides to somebody else's outsides. At the start of law school, I didn't feel I belonged. Everyone else had their act together. It was completely clear. They seemed to know where to buy books, who to study with, what the teachers expected, what the cases stipulated. I marveled at how people so new to this world seemed to fit right in. My best friend in the world, John Prendergast, and I call our heads bat caves. And yes, that's from Batman, the bat cave where all the bats flutter about. And this is because we're in our heads so often that sometimes it's hard to concentrate with all the bats swarming around. In law school, I spent a lot of time with the bats. All of us did, as HLS is a bat-friendly place, a place where fears and insecurities run rampant. Of course, the fact is that when people feel unsafe, they are the least likely to talk openly about their bats. It was not until a couple years into law school, as friendships tightened and as all of us unwound, that we each learned that self-doubt was the rule and not the exception. We were all confused and groping. The only thing that distinguished us was how well we hid it. I've had the identical experience in government. Soon after candidate Obama won in November 2008, I was offered my dream job to serve President Barack Obama and to help him implement his vision for multilateral affairs, human rights, and the prevention of mass atrocity and genocide from the White House. As they say, oh my God. When I arrived in Washington with my campaign teammates, I was no newer to this experience than many of my peers, but everyone around me had purposeful, directed strides while I felt I was staggering around, bewildered by the bureaucracy. I hadn't been there long when I had my first meeting with then, now suddenly, President Obama in the Oval Office. Since my office is not that far away, I left myself 5 minutes to get there. The only trouble was I couldn't find the Oval. Turns out nobody passes out maps of the West Wing, so I had printed out a small map from the Washington Post website, but it wasn't drawn to scale, and I ended up on the third floor when the Oval, which is, you might imagine, quite hard to miss, was on the second floor. By the time I found my way, I was late to my first meeting with President Obama. 7 months pregnant at the time, I was also breathless and completely discombobulated. When I walked in, General Jones, our national security advisor, and his deputy national security advisor were already seated. I sat down awkwardly, setting down the water bottle every pregnant woman keeps nearby, and trying to catch my breath before I had to start the briefing. Unfortunately, as soon as my battered Poland Springs bottle touched the surface of the centuries-old coffee table, a man I hadn't seen in fancy dress behind me reached over my shoulder and removed the unsanitary item from view of the 44th President of the United States. Now I'm in the equivalent of my 2L year in government, and every single one of my colleagues has told me a version of the story I just told you. When you get out into the real world, just like here, it's easy to believe that you and only you are the one who doesn't belong. When you get to Skadden, when you join the Department of Justice, when you take the Foreign Service exam, when you return to your country to start your own practice, when you walk into a philanthropist's office and make a pitch to raise money to launch your NGO, and you feel unsafe while everyone else seems to be brimming with confidence, remember, you see only their outsides. There could be a fleet of bats inside. Maybe that understanding will inspire not only a degree of calmness as you go forward, but also a compassion for others. Every one of you out there has a backstory, and probably a bat cave. Life is not about mastering uncertainty, it is about channeling it. Second tip is that selling out is really, really, really hard. And let me first define what I mean by selling out. By selling out, I do not mean working for a corporate law firm. By selling out, I do not mean making gobs of money. I just learned that you have paid $41,500 a year in tuition for the privilege of this remarkable education. That is an awful lot of money, and many of you probably have steep debt payments ahead of you. Though kudos to HLS for offering subsidies to those here in the summer and at other times who are exploring public interests. Kudos also, of course, to parents for supporting their kids where they were able. By selling out, though, I just mean doing something that requires you to check your heart at the door. I have classmates from HLS who are earning tons of money and love their lives. I have classmates from HLS who are earning tons of money and hate their lives because they don't actually want to be doing what they're doing. They read the class notes of the alumni magazine and sigh wistfully at the lives of others. No relative, friend, teacher, or graduation speaker can tell you what you should do. It's your compass, your values, your gut that will carry you. But if your compass, your values, and your gut don't like what you end up doing, I promise you that they will not keep quiet. First, they'll take a nap, waiting for you to pay back your loans or hoping that the days will get more stimulating and the law more fulfilling. But then the compass, the values, the gut will start to speak. First they will gnaw, and then they will tug, and at some point they will start screaming, no! This is the only life you have. You don't get a do-over. And then it will be time to make yourself vulnerable again, to take another plunge, even at the expense of releasing the bats. A job that doesn't feel right is no more likely to last than a marriage of the same description. It is hard to seek or experience inspiration when you're insulated in a life that isn't working for you. But even as you work your day job, if you start to feel that tug, try to expose yourself to places, issues, and people outside your comfort zone. People who defy gravity and make change later in life are seriously brave. Try, if you can, and you're in one of these phases, these moments, to remember that there are people out there who've stopped dreaming about a better world, have stopped believing that the blessed are also the just. Restore their faith that while they may feel forgotten, some kick-ass Harvard Law School graduate has their back. You've already done this while in law school. Each of you somehow did an average of 533 hours of pro bono service while here. How is that even possible structurally? And who are these mutant people, aliens, who did 2,500 hours of public service? I'm staggered by that. It's incredible. Nearly two-thirds of you did a summer of public interest. It's clear that you're searching, that you're seeking, that you're finding exposures. And no matter where you start out after you get out of this place, you can find your way back to loving what you do. It doesn't have to be the guy down the row from you who loves his job and respects himself. It can be you. But for that to happen, you will have to open your ears and try to hear your gut. Third tip, penultimate tip. In whatever you do, try to be fully present, truly present. As Satchel Paige put it, work like you don't need the money, love like you've never been hurt, dance like nobody's watching. You gotta be all in. This means leaving your technology behind occasionally and listening to a friend without half of your brain being occupied by the inner longing for the red light on your BlackBerry. I sat in on a close friend's Harvard Law School class a couple years ago. I slipped into the back row of Pound Hall Lecture Hall. I swear, just parenthetically, if I come to HLS as a senior citizen 40 years from now, I will still slink into the back row as the fear of getting called on will never leave me. Well, on this field trip to my friend's class, I got a glimpse of modern learning. Students had done away with spiral notebooks, and they had their laptops in front of them, typing away. But I was sitting in the back, and I looked forward, and almost every laptop I saw in the rows in front of me had split screens, notes from this particular law class, and then a range of parallel stimulants. One person was trolling through football statistics on ESPN, another was booking their flight home for Thanksgiving, and another was adding a friend on Facebook. What was so incredible about this is that when the students were called on, they managed not to betray, even for a second, that they were moonlighting. They were able to pull it off. You are remarkably good at multitasking. You have developed the modern muscle set. You are first-class grazers. And I say, I know of what I speak because I am a cardinal culprit. You have never seen an NSC official and new mother so dexterous in her ability simultaneously to BlackBerry and to breastfeed. Lovely image, right? But I promise you that over time, this actually just doesn't cut it. Something or someone will lose out. No more than a surgeon can operate while tweeting, can a public defender do his client justice or a corporate lawyer fend off motions with one ear in and one ear out. You actually have to reacquaint yourself with concentration, full-on concentration. We all do. We should all become, if we can, as Henry James prescribed, a person on whom nothing is lost. Fourth and finally, these are the good old days. I don't mean just your law school years or this gathering with family and friends. I mean every phase of your life stands a great chance later, retrospectively, of becoming a source of nostalgia and reminiscence, the good old days. Yet the same events, friendships, routines, challenges, that later become fond memories are too rarely savored in the moment. My husband Cass and I have learned some valuable lessons about this together. He's taught me this in a range of ways. As we leave the office at night, the fastest path to our car does not take us directly in front of the facade of the White House. But Cass insists we walk up the steps hand in hand, appreciative of the incredible opportunity this president has given us to serve our country. When we get home at night, we try to count our blessings. Silly as it seems, he makes us run through the 10 things we are most thankful for in every given day. And half of those things, as in people, are actually here with me today. Who or what is in your top 10? And how often do you take the time to reflect on that? Going forward, we're all vulnerable to accidents, personal tragedies, political and economic realities. But the one thing we control is how much of the journey we pause to appreciate. Albert Einstein once said, "There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle." Here, I'm with Einstein. Freeze this day in amber in your mind, because I promise these are the good old days. Harvard Law School, class of 2010, thank you so much for allowing me to share your incredible, incredible achievement. Remember that this is the only life you have, and you don't get a do-over. Argue well and fair. Never, ever forget the majesty of law and the privilege of having been anointed its guardian. Don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. Listen to your gut and know that a small contribution from you can make a giant difference to those who can never get here. Be present and savor every single one of these oh-so-precious good old days, starting with today. Best of luck, class of 2010. We need you. Thank you.
Thank you, Samantha Power, for joining us as we celebrate our impending graduation. You're right, we are overachievers, which is why we learned how to play with technology at the same time that we're briefing cases and being cold called. But that's not the only thing that has changed since you were here.
I mean, speaking of change, it seems in our 3 years here, everything has changed. I mean, everything. We've seen an alum become president of the United States.
The number of banks on the NASDAQ fall.
Our former dean become a Supreme Court nominee.
Even the landscape of our campus has changed. We've seen professors come and go.
Our grading system become incomprehensible.
And our coffee and tea that used to flow like milk and honey disappear. Despite all these changes, the foundation upon which generations of Harvard Law School graduates have built success remains. The amazing people who shape us and push us to excel. Our professors, who have shared their wealth of legal knowledge and life experience with us in our short 3 years here, have no equals at any other institution in the country. The Harvard Law School staff, from the Dean of Students' Office to our clinical instructors, to the offices of OPIA and Career Services, has worked tirelessly to promote our current and future well-being. Most importantly, our classmates are engaging, awe-inspiring, supportive, and surprisingly fun. Something I definitely didn't expect when I came to law school. Undoubtedly, each of you is a tribute to your amazing family and friends who have believed in you and loved you. Despite that, they really wish you would stop talking about law all the dang time. We have faced so many changes and economic uncertainties, but through these hard times, when the river of high salary jobs and free bagels ran dry, our class, the class of 2010, has shown tenacity and courage. And I think the years to come will show that we are more capable than any law school class before us of adapting to and thriving in the face of that change.
Absolutely. And I believe that tenacity and that courage is what is going to take us through the uncertain times ahead. Sure, we are living in uncertain times, but we are definitely living in an exceptional time. I mean, think about it. We won't just read about history. We get to live it, make it. And as important as the degrees we'll receive tomorrow are our experiences with each other, the times we've had together, our unique moment in history. Imagine the stories we'll tell. And may the bonds that we forged in classrooms and study halls and bar reviews be the beginning of something much bigger and much brighter for our future. That's our real commencement. Thank you all, and we'll see you tomorrow.